Good afternoon, everyone. I want to stay on time here just to double check. You are in a discussion of escalating inequality, the intersections of faith, race, and class. We are talking about the statement of conscience that the Commission on Social Witness will be writing, and that if all goes as planned, we'll be voting on this time next year as a statement of conscience. I'm the Reverend David Breeden, and I welcome you to this. I am a former commissioner on the Commission on Social Witness, but the commissioner who was scheduled to do this, Christina Saliari, was unable to come to GA, so I popped up and joined you today. Please be aware that we are recording, so any questions you have, please do come to the microphone so that people listening to this on their computers later can hear you. Also, when we do get to the question and answer part, I would like to do a little variation by having three people in a row ask questions and then and direct them, and then we will try to answer them a little bunched up so that we can get more questions in, if that's okay. I'm the senior minister at First Unitarian Society of Minneapolis, by the way, and as I said, a former commissioner on the Commission of Social Witness. And today we are looking to expand the conversation from politics to faith, to see the problem not as a problem of one particular political thing, but a matrix of oppressions. And we're trying to come up with a plan that is faithful to the principles of Unitarian Universalism. I am joined today, and by the way, if you have the app, there are fuller biographies on the app, because we've got a couple of, well, we've got three very impressive people on the panel today. First, Charlene Sinclair. She's the Director of Reinvestment at the Center for Community Change. She's the lead organizer of the Interfaith Organizing Initiative and its campaign for racial and economic justice. Charlene is also working on her PhD at Union Theological Seminary. The Reverend Dr. Shanta Premawardhara, I almost got that out, is the president of SCOOP, the Seminary Consortium for Urban Pastoral Education. He's a member of the Interfaith Organizing Initiative, and he serves on the board of the National Council of Churches. He's also a part of the Parliament of World Religions, the Common and Common Cause Illinois. Previously, he worked as the Director for Interreligious Dialogue and Cooperation at the World Council of Religions. And also we have with us today Susan Leslie, the Congregational Advocacy and Witness Director of the UUA. And I can tell you from personal experience, Susan is someone who knows how to turn talk into action, so we can trust her to be doing that. We're going to start off by framing up these issues a little bit. And please.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here. It is very good for me to be here with you all during this past 2 days. I enjoyed my time yesterday and today being with you at this important UU event. I'm very much spiritually akin to you, I'm discovering. So this is like being with brothers and sisters. And I'm very grateful to have been invited to participate in this panel. The work that we are talking about, I think, is critical for our time, obviously. That's why you are here as well. You believe that. I needed to rewrite some of my presentation today after listening to Bill Sinkford last night. I've known Bill for a while. For a period, I was at the National Council of Churches in New York, and we had many relationships with the UUA organization in Boston at the time. And so I came to know him and several others. So it was particularly good to hear him speak. What a prophetic voice, huh? See, I came to this country 35 years ago and bought into the myth of innocence. I'm one of those privileged ones to have left the country of my birth, which is Sri Lanka, and find my place among the privileged, racially bigoted white society of Chicago. Black, white, Latino, Latinas, Asians, we all do that. Sinkford said, we are given another chance by Black Lives Matter. I listened to his speech many times. It's on the website. It's on video. You can do that too because you can't get it all in one shot. I thought that he said some very important things, but he probably didn't say enough about how, and I want to try and push us into thinking about that. I lost my innocence. Perhaps I'm losing my innocence in stages, like how many of us are. Most significantly, it happened to me when I pastored a church in Chicago's South Side, in a neighborhood called Hyde Park that many of you know because many of you know Meadville Lombard. It's at the edge of, at the time, one of the nation's poorest communities. The Robert Taylor Homes was a whole large buildings that lined up the Dan Ryan Expressway for a very long time with thousands of families and people living in there without any economic opportunity. Those buildings we used to call projects were communities for people. Those are since destroyed and the communities demolished, the buildings demolished and the community destroyed since then. But this is where I really began to examine my life and our common public life from the underside. I had people in my church who lived in that community. I needed to visit them there. I needed to take my middle-class white friends to prayer meetings and Bible studies in those communities. And people refused to go because there was violence. There was a smell of urine in the elevators. And people were extremely poor in those communities. You go into one of those apartments and open the refrigerator, there's nothing there. And there are no beds that people sleep on. This is the kind of life that people lived from the underside. My losing of innocence meant for me looking at life, at theology, at society, at economics, from that side. The reason Bill Sinkford's address so resonates with me is because this is what my organization called SCOOP is trying to do. It is trying to build religious and community leaders, trying to build leaders who have lost their innocence and are able to actually now, from that perspective, begin to engage in communities. So we've come up with a slogan for ourselves, and we say that what we do is listen to, learn from, and live in deep solidarity with those in the margins. Listen to, learn from, and live in deep solidarity with those in the margins. L3M, we call it. Listen to, learn from, living in deep solidarity with those in the margins. If there's anybody most in need of and most eager to challenge and to change the status quo, it is the people in the margins. The problem, we have said, and Sinkford would agree, are our received theologies. We call them received theologies. Received theologies are those theologies that are so aligned with empire. Empire meaning the hegemonic systems of power and privilege. Like Sinkford, we call our leaders to acknowledge our privilege, that is our myth of innocence, identify with those in the margins, and view life, its social, political, and economic systems from that perspective. One such public theologian is one of our former faculty members, an American Baptist minister, an African-American by the name of Osagyefo Uhuru Seku. I don't know if you know him. Some of you may do. He, since 2000, August of 2014, since Michael Brown was killed, has been in Ferguson at the forefront of the protest movement there, organizing and training young people in the methods of and disciplines of nonviolent civil disobedience.
He was here last night, seeing it.
Was he?
Yep.
Okay. I didn't know that. I would have loved to see him. We brought him once to speak to us, I think it was last year, and he said that I may have said this to you as well. He said, these young people, he said over and over again, these young people, these queer black young women and these saggy-panted young men are the very ones leading us towards the movement of justice. Those who are most marginalized in society are leading where the church is failing to go. This is where God is speaking, he said, and the church is not listening. It's 50 years since Martin Luther King. It is 50 years since the Voting Rights Act. 50 years since Bloody Sunday in Selma. It is as if nothing has changed. It's open season on black men and women. So he asked this question. What is wrong with our theology that 50 years later we are still struggling with this? Notice the framing of the question. What is wrong with our theology? And what we are trying to say is that what is wrong is that we deal with what we call a received theology and not a theology that arises from the ground where those young people are struggling. Bill Sinkford nailed it. It's a privileged theology, he said, built on a myth of innocence. We are given another chance, he said, and that is to build a faith tradition that lives down here with us, down here in the world. So, this is our chance. Another of our faculty members, Jörg Rieger, taught at Southern Methodist University Perkins School of Theology until recently, now moved to Vanderbilt, recently wrote a book about 2 years ago now called Theology, Religion, and Class, in which he makes the case that not only our work on race and LGBTQ and gender, the question of class is something that is very urgent. My friend Alan Lindrup is here from Hyde Park, so I'm saying this with carefully. You might have heard this, Alan, but in my community we say, we don't have a race problem. Black and white people hold hands against the poor. Indeed, our discomfort in trying to understand and engage the question of economic justice is in part because of our myth of innocence. Today, we can't do that. Occupy movement gave us the language of 1% and 99%. Bernie Sanders lifted it up as a political platform. And the myth we've held for so long that in this land of opportunity, each of us can aspire to be billionaires if we worked hard and made the right decisions has crumbled like the house of cards that it is. But our theologies, built to support empires, keep holding us back. So 2 years ago, we invited South African theologian Alan Buzak to address this question. You all know Alan Buzak. At a time when apartheid was a theologically approved doctrine of the church, Buzak spearheaded a theological movement that led the World Alliance of Reformed Churches to declare apartheid a heresy. With that, the back of apartheid was broken. So we told Alan, we need another theological moment. We used to believe in an important idea called common good, we said. Good in the sense not good versus bad or evil. Good in the sense of goods, things, money. We used to call it commonwealth. It came from an old biblical idea where the disciples used to come together and share everything in common, so nobody had any need. We used to call it commonwealth, and the early American colonies called them commonwealths. We've lost that, we said, in favor of our pursuit of individual wealth, such that we are living in a time of soaring wealth disparities, which making our democracy even untenable, makes it a plutocracy. I don't need to give you the details about what the wealth disparities are today. You can Google it. It's all out there. 67 people own more than half the world's wealth, 42 million per person. See, we need a new theological moment, we said to Alan Buzak, a movement that breaks the back of prosperity theologies that say, if you are favored by God, then you will become rich. Or if you are rich, that means you are favored by God. And the corollary of that, if you are poor, you are in God's disfavor. Now, you might say this is all these TV preachers and prosperity theologians who are saying, that is easy to say. Let's be clear. It's easy for us to say that and say these people are just beyond the pale. We need to just cut them off. But if you were to think about what goes on in our churches in the mainline Christian traditions and think about the theologies that we preach and we in our liturgies and in our hymnody, you will discover that this is really not that far from the truth. This is what we believe. We really do believe that. So we said to Alan and others, we need to work on that, and we came up with a really good document called Together Building a Just Economy. And that document is sitting there in the back. If you want, please take one. There are a number of copies there that encourages us to stand with communities of resistance that are at the margins. Bill Sinkford would like that. You also heard that I work for the World Council of Churches, which is a large ecumenical organization internationally. And the World Council of Churches has been working on this for a long time. A group called Poverty, Wealth, and Ecology has engaged theologians, economists, and sociologists on a discussion on economic justice for several years. In October 2012, they offered a groundbreaking proposal for a new financial architecture that included the establishment of a greed line. The study group studied this idea, published its report recently, and it is right here, the greed line. The greed line, you can get this. It's easy to get from Amazon, not very expensive. If we can establish a poverty line below which a person is said to be in poverty and is deserving of public assistance, then can economists come and create a greed line above which somebody can be said to be greedy? What that means, though, is that when somebody is said to be greedy, then you can actually create a taxation mechanism that takes some of the excess wealth that this person has and put it back into common good, to commonwealth, to public money. That's the idea. So there are multi-dimensional indicators such as wealth accumulation and resulting increase in the levels of poverty, levels of wealth disparity in the world today, and the increase in ecological footprint that arises because of increased consumption. Those are the multidimensional factors they took into consideration. It's a great book. It's a great study. Yet several questions remain unresolved. First, greed is at the bottom not an economic question. Greed is a spiritual question, requiring spiritual answers. And I want to say the only institution with competency to address that question are religious communities, because it's a spiritual question. The second point is that the only way policymakers will even consider addressing radical proposals like this is if their hand is forced through organized movements that call for such an overhaul of economic systems. As long as religious communities themselves are caught up in an economic system based on greed, and don't have the adequate theological resources or the courage to organize themselves into a movement, they will not address that either. "We have a chance to change," said Bill Sinkford. "In my tradition, we call it a come to Jesus moment." It is a call for repentance, to acknowledge our privilege, our addiction to greed, and the myth of innocence that perpetuates it, and to look at reality from the point of view of those in the margins. That's a lot of internal work that we need to do in order to come to grips with what is going on in our own lives with that question of the myth of innocence, and how we recognize our level of privilege and the difficulty that each of us have to look at reality from the other side. Then there's the external work, taking it out. As you saw from the Brexit vote, UK is following our Trumpism and giving into xenophobia. And in the midst of the House Democrats sitting on gun violence, you saw what our Republican Congress people did. They passed a bill trying to override a veto of President Obama that strengthened the rules on brokers. So they wanted to relax the rules on brokers. But you know, UU communities are not the only ones who are concerned about this. Christian communities across the country are concerned about this across the world. But it is not only them. Buddhists and Muslims and Jews and Hindus and other religious people are concerned about that. Let us not think that we have the corner on that. I could give you lots of examples. I don't have time to do that today, but I've written about this as well. But there are lots of examples about how Buddhist spiritualities, Muslim spiritualities, Hindu spiritualities can lead us to a new way of thinking. Jewish spiritualities can lead us to a new way of thinking, which means simply this. If we who are UUs and Christians can get our act together on our theologies, there are partners in those communities that can actually be good partners for us to work on this. Friends, religious communities are about the most organized communities in the world. I don't know if you realize that. Religious communities, wherever you go in the world, there are religious communities. Wherever, even in the smallest villages, there are religious communities. And they gather together in either in small groups of 20 or large groups of 20,000. And they gather about once a week. And one person gets up in front of them and says something like, "This is what is God's will for you." And a lot of people try to follow that. Just imagine that. And we also know how to collect money. But just imagine if 10% of those people were to be engaged in looking, in breaking through that myth of innocence, looking at reality from the point of view of the margins, organizing ourselves in order to enact some of these things. What a huge difference we can make. It's not just us UUs, it's all of the other religious people as well are organized. It is time for us to take this. Sinkford said, we have to take this challenge seriously. If we do that, then we will have a movement. That, I hope, is what we are all about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shanta. This is, by the way, if you've come in late, the CSW hearing, little talk back about escalating inequality, intersections of faith, race, and class. We will be writing a statement of conscience about that coming up this year, and the Commission on Social Witness would like to hear what you think about that issue. Greed is a spiritual problem, Shanta said. UUs have long been called the praying wing of the Democratic Party. Well, how do we go beyond the politics of the Democratic Party and make this a faith issue? What I'd like to do is break for about 5 minutes, and you can turn to your neighbor if you would, and just think about this question. What is wrong with our theology, as Shanta asked, what is wrong with our theology? How do we get our act together? So let's chat about that for about 5 minutes. For reflecting on that question. Being UUs, I know it's a little hard to reel back in and get our attention up here. But if you can focus back in the front here, we now have Charlene Sinclair. She is the Director of Reinvestment at the Center for Community Change.
Good afternoon. So I do want to thank you for being in this space with all of us collectively, and to thank my friend and colleague, Susan Leslie in particular. Susan is a comrade, a co-conspirator, a prod in my back, and just, you know, an amazing woman and a dear friend. And so I just wanted to publicly say how much I appreciate her and thank her for being just who she is in this movement. So yesterday, you know, coming to the UUGA is almost like coming to a family reunion, because I went to Union Theological Seminary, and so many of my colleagues there are and were UUs. So I'm seeing folks all in the hallways, and so it is a family reunion for me. And I mentioned to one of my friends, who I think I saw in here somewhere, she said, well, what are you going to talk about? And I said, well, I have no idea. I'm just going to let the Spirit figure it out for me. And you know, it turned out to be more that than I even anticipated, actually, because I realized over the last couple of days that I had a lot of stuff sort of roiling inside of me. And I don't know how many people sat in on Alicia Garza's talk with Caitlin at all, and how many people like me have been looking at the news and seeing all that is going on, you know, and over the last months, you know, not just over the last couple of days. But I realize that so much of that has affected me very deeply. And as I thought about what to talk about, I realized that instead of being up here as a panelist, I'd rather just be in conversation with you as colleagues and just, you know, talk together and think together, because I think that that's really important. And so the first thing I want to reflect on is this presentation I had gone to, because I think that will frame sort of where my head and heart is right now. I was in South Africa, and I attended a presentation on body mapping. And in this presentation, they talked about this therapeutic way in which they enter into communities to have people begin to think through their own histories. And the whole body mapping process came up as a response to the huge HIV/AIDS epidemic in South Africa. And one of the reasons why they wanted people to capture their histories was because the death rate was so high that this became a way in which mothers and fathers and grandmothers could actually give to their children, you know, a physical history of their lives. So the way the body mapping occurred was that they would have someone lay on the floor, and they would draw an outline of their bodies. And then they would take crayons, markers, paints, etc., and fill that outline in with their history. And it just it's powerful, right? It's like immensely powerful and moving. And the presenter at the time then began to show us images of these body maps. And I just was gripped by this, because not only was I gripped by what these amazing men and women, grandmothers, et cetera, had created, but I was also gripped by what it did to me. Because as I looked at the outlines of those bodies, I was then transported to the outlines of the bodies on the streets here in the U.S. as we move through communities, those outlines on the streets actually are exactly like those outlines there. But instead of being a way in which your history is celebrated, it's a statement of how your future is cut off. And so as I thought about these body maps, I thought about the lines more as these boundaries, these interstices, these lines between the promise of a life and the result of that promise unmet. And then I began to think about, what does that mean for us? What does that mean for us here in the U.S. when those border lines, those body lines, are seen more than we see the actual lived lives of people? That body line now became that space where, instead of joy and care and love, all I could see was oppression and joblessness, exploitation, addiction, mental illness. And then I realized, for so many people, you know, the life that they walk is within these dead zones, just waiting for that body line and not reaching for possibility and promise. You know, I read this article, and it's amazing. I feel as though Shanta and I were in dialogue with each other, because the title of this article was The Essence of Innocence. But it talked about, and let me give you the subtitle. I'll give you the whole thing. The Essence of Innocence, Consequences of Dehumanizing Black Children. And in that research, they found, and I'm going to give you the quotes because I think it's important that we hear this. But the researchers found that there is converging evidence that black boys are seen as older and less innocent, and that they prompt a less essential conception of childhood than do their white same-age peers. They also found that the Black Ape Association depicted actual racial disparities in police violence towards children, and suggests that dehumanization is a uniquely dangerous intergroup attitude. I'm going to say that part again. Dehumanization is a uniquely dangerous intergroup attitude. That's what I want to talk about. Because if we do not see people as people, if we do not make commitments to each other as people, then we will do anything to each other. We will let each other starve. We will let each other go without health care. We will let each other be shot in the streets. We will let each other go uneducated. We will do anything to each other. Stuart Hall, who is a cultural theorist, he's Jamaican by birth and grew up in Britain. He wrote this book called The Crisis of Policing. And in this book, he talked about the creation of a moral panic. The moral panic was actually developed so that when you saw young boys of other ethnicity on the street corners in Britain, you began to panic, to think that there was something wrong, to think that, yes, police presence is needed. So rather than to think, why are they on the streets? Why do we not have an education system that will gather them up and give them possibilities? Why do we have people that are not eating? Why do we have folks that actually have to look to underground trade in order to pay their bills? Why do we have people homeless in the streets? Those were not the crisis of panic. The crisis of panic were the actual images of these young boys. So when we begin to think about the concept of rising inequality and greed, we have to think about, how are we ourselves formed to the point in which we don't think that that's a problem, but we're rather more concerned about how we keep ourselves, quote unquote, safe from those outsiders. You know, this past semester, I taught a class on ethics at a seminary in North Carolina. And one of the theologians that we discussed was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer is actually one of my favorite theologians. Not because of the theological planks that we normally hear about, you know, what is Christology and all of those things. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer actually spent time at Union Theological Seminary. And he critiqued it. I don't know if people know this. He critiqued Union Theological Seminary because he said that the people at Union, they could tell you all about social disparities and they could be social service people. And at the end of the day, what was their faith saying? They were so divorced from that fundamental, deep understanding of how their faith should move them that they were going through, you know, motions and feeling good about those motions rather than actually engaging from this place of deep moral conviction. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in the midst of the rise of Nazism and in the midst of Hitler's rise, he goes back to Germany because he said he cannot be a part of the solution if he is not engaged in the struggle with his people. Right? You have to be engaged in the struggle. He went back and he engaged in thinking about, like, what could he do? And he made tough decisions. There were his decisions to make, but he made tough decisions. But in the class, the students said, but how could they not see what was going on? You know, I mean, because here in the U.S., we think we're kind of sanctimonious over in the U.S. My God, how could they not see, right? And how did they not know? The reality is it was going on right in their own communities. You had incinerators in communities. People smelled the ashes. They smelt the burned bodies. It became so much a part of their everyday lives that they just went on to work, to school, visiting neighbors. Meanwhile, people were burning in incinerators. And my class was appalled. But then the question became, where are the burning bodies that you're walking past? What's happening that you've become so inured to that you don't even see it anymore? Why is it, you know, the image that I keep in my mind is, you know, we've had so many deaths. You know, when Alicia Garza said, you know, we're dying out here, it is true. It is true. The image that I keep in my mind is of Tamir Rice. He was a baby. And we're not outraged. How can we not be outraged? How can we not say this is wrong? Now, you might ask me, what does this have to do with rising inequality? Everything. Everything. Because we cannot have rising inequality if we don't have deep despair in just the depths of folks that have nothing. We cannot have rising inequality if you, I mean you, the collective, don't believe that some people should have and some shouldn't. Shanta talked about a received theology. A theology is not just God talk. A theology is what you believe in your life. What you own as the very structuring of your existence. That's your religion. Now, if your religion tells you that's wrong, we'd be in the streets. But your religion, somewhere inside of you, your religion is saying it's okay. And if we don't investigate that, we can't make changes happen. I'll say two last things before I sit down, because I think I might be at time. But one piece is an essential part of what Shanta said when he talked about greed. I focus in a lot on Reinhold Niebuhr, his first, you know, big book, Moral Man and Immoral Society. And what Niebuhr said was that, you know, we can have levels of morality with ourselves, with our family members, but when we start going further and further out, it becomes harder and harder for us to actually love each other in that deep and critical way. So when we begin to think about what it would take for us to actually turn this structure that we have developed on its head, then we will have to begin to start getting to the place where we're not simply pointing the fingers at the 1%, but we're looking at the 99%. Because the 1% can't exist unless we consent to their existence, right? So we've got to look at the 99%, not by saying you 1% are wrong, by saying to each other, what must we do to craft a different society where people and not profit reign, where people flourish and not 1% flourish? How do we do that together? You know, I come out of a Christian faith, and so I look at the work of the Apostle Paul when he asks for the collective. In the collective, he said, let us have enough. Let us gather from everyone so that all would have. You know, and I thought about that, and we think about it in really charitable terms. But imagine if the 99% lived differently. Imagine if the 99% said we must have a different world. If the 99% said, no, it is immoral and it is wrong for 1% to own most of the wealth in the world. What if the 99% said that? What if the 99% locked arms and said, we insist on something different? What would happen? The way in which we do this, you already have in your theological, you know, wellspring. As you use, you believe in the inherent worth of people. Orlando Patterson said, the way you enslave someone is to be so totally uncaring and not feel any responsibility for them. A natal alienation, he called it. To be so alienated from each other that you don't care. But you believe in the inherent worth of people. But be careful, because that could lead to a radical individualism. Be careful, right? But you have something else that helps that, the interconnectedness of existence. With these two planks, if you delve into that wellspring, you have the makings of getting that 99% to be together. You, as you use, already have in your theological length and dignity and width, you have what it takes to be able to do this. The question is, do you have the courage to do it? That's the question. Can you be brave enough to do it? Now, it's easy to talk about the inherent worth of people if you're only talking about yourself, right? Now you have to take that other step and begin to think about how does that happen with each of us together. It's a tough step, but we have to take it. Are you up for it? What? Nope. I'm not hearing anything. Are you up for it? Are you up for it? I think you are. I think you're up for it. A key to being up for it, though, is to realize that all of these things everything that comes together is done so that we get so distracted sometimes, right? But if we have at our center, what does it take to make sure every human being's inherent worth, which means that they have the ability to live full and wholesome lives, where they can have all of their creative imagination captured through good education, where they can eat so that they can be present and visible and engage with that, where they can actually have the resources to provide for themselves so that they can feel dignified, where they can actually create who they are within a construct of humanness. You know, not the narrowness of any particular identity, but within that broader construct of being human, I can decide for myself what that looks like. That's amazing. That's world changing. That is world changing. And we can do it. And if we do that, then a concept of fighting for 15 shouldn't be that difficult. My God, 15 is not enough. Who can live off of $15 an hour? Have you tried living off of $15 an hour in New York City? Yes, most of us do. Most of us make less than that. I'm hearing people say Bernie Sanders is outrageous. He wants, you know, complete college education for everyone. That's where we've come to? That is a fantasy? That's what we're living in? That's crazy. But then we're comfortable with the fact that Donald Trump has, you know, he's in freaking Scotland talking about his golf course. And we're not critiquing that, but I'm hearing people say Bernie Sanders is crazy for wanting full college education for everyone. That's what we've come to. How do we turn inequality upside down if we are actually perpetuating that kind of hegemonic framework? It can't be done. It can't be done. We got to do something different. And you all, each and every one of you, already have one step forward, right? So the question is looking, grabbing everyone. We're doing this together. What are you doing there dragging behind? Get your butt up here. Right? That's what it's going to take. And I know you can do it. I'm going to check in with Susan. I'm going to check in with Susan because Susan is now going to tell you all about one way in which you can begin. Right? Oh, you're going to do first?
I'm going to ask him a question first.
Oh, David's going to ask a question first.
Right? Is that all right?
Maybe we'll do three. We'll do something quick for three-minute question. How about that? And trim it off. But does that sound good?
No.
Yeah?
No, I want
to go
before you do.
Oh, okay. You do that.
Because these guys are on a roll, and I just want to keep it going, all right? So I'm Susan Leslie, UUA's Congregational Advocacy and Witness Director, and I'm wondering how many people were at the rally last night at the Witness. Well, Charlene and I had a meeting with Reverend Barber last night, and some of what we're looking at is combining forces. You know, we saw a real moral revival there last night, and we are also about to launch the Enough campaign. Enough. And I think you heard all those heads of communion and many of the activists talking about enough. And they did that on purpose because the Interfaith Organizing Initiative that Charlene is the lead organizer of and that Reverend Shanta Prema Wardhana is also a member of, and we've been working together on this for a couple of years, of how can we, in the interfaith community, in partnership with people who are organizing people at the margins, really make a difference. And Charlene had organized a summit on the intersection of criminalization and race. And we were all together. There were hundreds of us in Chicago. And we were like, okay, well, we'll make as the first thing ending mass incarceration, right? Then Ferguson happened, and Black Lives Matter got legs off of the youth of Ferguson. And we said, we've got to be looking and going for so much more than that. It's not just reforming the criminal justice system. We have to change completely how we live. Why can, as Shonda said, why can we not have full employment for people, for everybody to be educated? How can we not have that? And they have opened up space, and there should be no turning back now, because these moments do not happen very often, and you have to grab them before they close. And we've already, since Ferguson, seen them trying to close it. The backlash, the Trump movement, that is real. So along the way, one of our wins has to be that we stop that movement. Okay, so Enough is launching right around July 4th. And we will be lifting up a lot of people. We'll be lifting up Frederick Douglass's How Can the Slave Celebrate Independence Day? We need to draw really sharply the contradiction between what we celebrate and what we live. So there are going to be regional op-eds from some of the people that you saw on the stage last night, heads of communion saying this is the most important thing that we can do. You know, and Reverend Barber's out there with the Moral Revival Tour, and we're connecting with them. We're going to have regional op-eds, and we asked you last night to sign up. You got to sign up. You got to go to love@uua.org, sign up. You can also go on the sign-up sheets I have in the back here today. And the way we're framing this is, first of all, we've got to challenge the dominant narrative out there. We have got to speak truth. And we are going to have a series of speakouts in strategic places right around the time of the presidential debates, because we do want to use the electoral cycle as a megaphone for our message. And we can be like, they're talking about that? What are they talking about? This is what the people are talking about. This is what we need to talk about. And after we've defeated the Trump movement, we'll be getting together at the beginning of December to have a strategic summit on what are the people's demands. And we are going to be bringing those demands to the new administration in the first 100 days, and we are going to set the organizing agenda with strategy and plans for going forward, not just in the first 100 days, but beyond. Because when you think about it, in 2008, everybody was like, we're done after the election, right? No, we know we weren't done, and we didn't move fast enough in those first 100 days. We've learned some stuff. And I just want to amplify, that's the politics and the strategy, but it is the faith community who can really lift this up, who can really say, from all the world's religions, this is not how we are meant to live. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Enough.
Thanks, Susan. You did need to say that. You noticed a little disjunct there, Charlene, because, you know, you weren't asking a rhetorical question, were you? And we were that's a rhetorical question. We'll think about that later. It's not a rhetorical question, right? It really, really is not a rhetorical question. We often answer these sorts of issues, as you use, turning into sociologists, and by, again, looking to the planks of the Democratic Party. But I want you to reflect for about 5 minutes here now on something that Charlene asked, and that is not a rhetorical question, but what kind of neighborhood do you live in, and what burning bodies are you ignoring? How are you going to engage in this struggle? We'll give you about 5 minutes to talk to your neighbor about those questions. We do need to honor the time. If you'll focus back up here, I know it's hard to get past those conversations, but if you'll focus up, we do need to honor our time and end at 2:30 today. What I want to do now is have you ask some questions, but we don't have very much time. So what I would like to do, if you'll come to the mic, those who have questions, and tell us your name and the congregation you're from, and if three people will ask a question at once,
so that, and maybe we can have then our panelists kind of pull those questions together so we can get some more information. What are we doing here? This is about the Statement of Conscience on Escalating Inequality. The Commission on Social Witness is listening and will listen to this tape and is listening as they begin to work. Right over there, we've got one with the hat. There's, yay! And they will be listening and thinking about what you've been saying while as they write the Statement of Conscience. So if you'll tell us your name and congregation and ask a question.
My name is Brian Larson. I'm from the First Unitarian Church in Shaker Heights, Ohio. My question is, in order to accomplish the kinds of things that we're talking about here, is it fundamentally necessary that capitalism must go?
All right. One more. Now, another question, please, ma'am.
Okay. Gay Sloan West Shore. Susan Gettler mentioned a blog on the social justice thing, and I'm wondering if that includes the kind of thing that, like, we can share what we've learned about escalating inequality, you know, in the course of studying and trying to act on it.
I will have to find out an answer to that question. And one more question, sir, and then we'll...
Alan Ludrup from First Unitarian Society of Chicago. My question, I guess, is forethinking. We do expect that, you know, as a continuation of the trend we've seen in recent decades, that we're going to see more and more automation, computerization. You've probably heard about the study from Osborne and Fry and so forth, that about 47% of current American jobs are likely to disappear in the next 20 years because of the changes. And so how does the response from the UU community and others who are thinking about economic inequality, the new social safety nets we'll likely need as we see an overall increase in unemployment, underemployment, et cetera, in the decades to come?
Right. So I'm going to take those, the capitalism and the computerization question together, because they're wrapped up in the same question. So must capitalism go? This is Charlene Sinclair's politics that you're going to hear. But capitalism, by its very nature, requires a level of aggressive dehumanization and an aggressive accumulation, just by its very nature. What we're talking about in terms of, because when you think about it, in order for you to have a capitalist society, that means you have to pull out the surplus labor for profit in some ways, right? And so when you talk about this increased computerization and increased technology, what we're seeing is that what is the utilization of people that may be unskilled or not skilled for the future that we are seeing through technology and technological development? We have made decisions that those people should be disposed of by just not giving them anything at all, disposed of by criminalizing the ways in which they attempt to live. We have already made determinations around that question. We as a society need to understand that we've made those determinations. The question becomes, do we want to make other determinations? Now, we can do that, because if we are entering into an age with increased technology, we have a couple of avenues. One is that we have to adequately prepare the actual labor market, the labor force, to engage in those technologies. In many communities, poor communities, communities of color, that's not where the preparation is going. And so increased joblessness, no jobness, et cetera, continues to happen in those communities. The other piece that we have to make the determination around, what does labor look like? What does labor market participation look like? Right now, the decisions that we've made is that not only do we not need the same amount of people, but the small amount of people that we're going to have engaged, we're going to have them work longer hours. We're going to have them work 2 and 3 jobs, rather than saying that the way in which we think about labor should be opened and expanded so that maybe people go to part-time work. Maybe we actually think about the fullness of labor, not just what we consider to be good labor in terms of good wages. Like, we have people that are doing labor now that aren't getting paid at all. The level of child care that exists in communities, the level of elder care that exists, and we're not actually allowing people to live or to support themselves on that. So we have to actually rethink how we think about the economy, how do we think about labor, as we think about this issue of increasing computer and technological advancement. So when we call for full employment, What we're saying is that everyone should be able to live, and we should actually package that in whatever way is necessary, and everyone contributes to society, and the people that are unable, either through disability or through their elderly status, if they are not able to contribute in the ways in which we actually see society moving, they're contributing anyway. They're contributing to what they bring to society. And so we need to rethink. This still is still a question of how do we rethink human beings? Because that's actually what is at stake here in its most fundamental form.
We've got about 5 minutes, so let's take three questions. And
okay. I was very inspired by Dietrich Bonhoeffer when I was in undergrad school planning to go to seminary. I read the part about where he says, when God calls a person, he calls them to come and die. And I thought, well, that's a little more than I had in mind. You know, and there's a lot of fallback positions that aren't quite as challenging as that that some of us could be involved in. And I don't want to feel immoral about not being quite that courageous, but is there sort of a fallback way for some of us more cautious people to be part of what you're advocating for us to do?
I was interested in what you were saying about packaging. I'm glad you brought that up. Thing is, we have a lot of people that are really put a lot of thought into how to sell us various commodities. And I'm just wondering how we can reverse the culture and put as much thought into convincing people about social justice and peace in the same way that they think about how to sell me toothpaste and, you know, Coca-Cola and stuff like that. You know, it just seems like there's something wrong with the picture here. We need to figure out how to package that. And then I also want to know how I can get involved in what you're doing and help to do that for you.
My name is Edie Jessup, Humboldt Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And my question is to ask you about the theology of charity, both in Unitarian Universalism and all the world's religion, and how that has become a fallback for not doing what morally needs to be done.
Yeah, we'll take you to the last question. Okay. Package him up.
Peter Candace, Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the Lowcountry in South Carolina. I just kind of want to follow on question what Charlene was saying. I think that a really important aspect would be a guaranteed annual income. I think if we put the savings that we would realize from a lot of the social programs and that sort of thing towards that guaranteed income so that people didn't have to have undercover jobs, and if you could address that, it would be great.
Great. And Shanta, would you take a shot at the theology of charity and the packaging of social justice and what we can do short of dying, perhaps? And yes, take a shot.
Let me start at the dying question. There's a really fine book called Leadership Without Easy Answers by Heifetz. In the last chapter of that book, it analyzes Martin Luther King's strategy, and he said how to be a leader and not die. His point was, you know, there are strategies that it is more important for you to live than to die. If you want to do what you have to do regardless of the consequences of what you have to do, but there are strategies you can follow in order that you may not be able to try to avoid dying in order to get the things you want to get done. So there's some thinking that has gone on in that area. That is not to say that we step back and you're not amoral if you want to live. But the point is the point is it's better for you to be living than dead. Let's say. On the matter of charity, I think it is indeed a fallback position, but not only that, it's an easy position. And churches, I've had this fight with churches for a very long time who want to do good charity work, but spend all their energy doing the charity work and therefore not engaging in the justice work. When you start doing your food pantries and your after-school tutoring and all of that kind of stuff, at the end of the day, there is no energy left in the church in order to engage in justice. So we keep serving the same people who keep coming Saturday after Saturday or week after week, and nothing changes. So I think there is a fundamental disconnect between charity and justice work that's going on in our churches that needs to be challenged, and challenged rather strongly.
We will have to end on that note, but... Susan.
And, you know, I do just want to say it is changing the dominant narrative and doing it publicly. So I'm not just pushing enough, like that's the only thing you can do, but it really is something that we have all these multi-faith folks coming together to do. Because as Shanta said, it is the spiritual communities that need to and must take the lead here. So please sign up, because I'll keep you all connected on what's going on.
Thank you all for coming today. Stay tuned and stay engaged. Thank you, Charlene and Susan and Shanta. And keep your eye on Susan Leslie and what we're doing. And I think I'll end on Charlene's quote from Paul, which is, "Let us have enough." Amen.